You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to Stay Ahead, a BI Norwegian Business School podcast, where practice meets theory and theory meets practice. Today, we have a special episode of the Strategy as Practice series, as we are recording live at the ONS conference in Stavanger. Today's topic is innovation throughout the organization. And I ask the question, is innovation caused by the few or the many? Today, I have the pleasure of having with me Christian Rynning Tønnesen, the CEO of Statkraft since 2010, and Carl Fay, our new Provost for Research and Social Impact at BI Norwegian Business. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
My name is Thomas Borgen. I'm an industrial PhD candidate at BI and the host of today's conversation. The backdrop for this conversation could probably not be more relevant. We are in the midst of a challenging energy situation, substantial global climate issues, and a demanding energy supply position, particularly in Europe. How has Statkraft, who has become Europe's largest producer of renewable energy with an ever-growing presence in other international markets, worked on innovation? And even more importantly, how does management think about innovation and dealing with the triangular challenge of energy security, energy affordability, and energy renewability? But Christian, before we deep dive into your and Statkraft's angle on innovation, what's your high-level analysis of our present energy situation, and particularly in Europe?
The energy situation in Europe, as we all know, is very challenging. And the root cause is the gas supply from Russia has been throttled down to a fraction of what it was in connection with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And because of this lack of gas, gas prices have soared. They are roughly 10 times higher now than what they were before it all started. Five times higher than a year ago, depending on when you compare. So, and then again, a part of this gas is used to produce electricity. So the high cost of gas is directly impacting the electricity market and has also caused electricity prices to soar. So this is a major problem for all European nations, the high cost of gas and electricity. The solution to this in the short term is partly to compensate consumers and some businesses that need it, because the cost of energy is simply too high for everybody to afford it. But it's not an easy task. Also, EU is looking at some system changes to the market itself, which is also not easy. In the long run, the only viable solution is to replace the previous Russian gas with other sources of energy. And here, renewable energy will play a major role.
Exactly. So basically what you're describing, we have a major disruption in the energy system of maybe expected or unexpected happenings. But 80% of our energy is still relying on fossil fuels. And to increase the speed of change requires, I presume, continuous technological breakthroughs and substantial investments and solid leadership. How are you and Statkraft thinking about this journey going forward from the innovation and leadership point of view?
It starts with the philosophy of the company. What do we want to achieve? What is our high-level target? And for us, being already from many years ago a leading company in hydropower and to some extent also into wind power, we have decided that we will dedicate our company to do renewable investments only to fight climate change. Because climate change is the highest threat of all in the energy business, 3/4 of all climate gases comes from energy that are fossil. Oil, coal, and gas, and the burning of those fuels. So we need to move from a world that is dominantly fueled by fossil energy to a world that is dominantly fueled by renewable energy. And Statkraft is one of the leading companies that can take part in this transition. So there's we can talk about the innovation part of this, but it starts with the philosophy of the company, and that is to develop and operate renewable energy on a high industrial scale, and thereby contribute to actually changing the composition of the world's energy sourcing.
It's a fascinating philosophy and underlying foundation. I think we should go back to that, but let me bring in Carl here. I mean, Carl, one of your many research interests is innovation. And to solve and move forward the way Christian says, we may have to move in unprecedented speed. And we need to involve several stakeholders. And they need to push in the same direction, that being politicians, research institutions, universities like BI, private enterprises, and so forth. How do we as a society find that kind of alignment? And do we find it?
So it's not easy, but it is something that we indeed need to work with. And unfortunately, probably business schools around the world on average haven't done a very good job of integrating and interacting the amount that's needed with various stakeholders, such as companies, such as politicians, et cetera. But this has to happen going forward. One of the key things that we're trying to do at BI now is make sure that researchers are not simply doing research, sitting in their offices, but that they're out talking to companies, collecting data, and then afterwards trying to get this work applied in companies much more. So how does this happen? It happens through having clear goals of what you want to do. It happens through having much interaction like we're having here at ONS, one of the reasons that this year BI has a big presence here. I think we're going to do a lot more of this moving forward. I sure hope so. So this conversation is really a great starting point.
But before we now again move into to Statkraft, Christian, do you believe now that we have a common understanding between most of the stakeholders of the situation, how to move forward?
I think when you're talking about solving the climate crisis, it is generally accepted in Europe. Not with enough dedication that we need, but it is understood. In the rest of the world, it's quite varying. But talking about innovation, we should remember that it is not enough to come up with and identify the good ideas. It's the combination of doing that and actually implementing it at large scale that makes changes. So the implementation part is equally important as the discovery of the new innovation itself.
And then let's move into to your area and your company. And because Statkraft has historically, or maybe even today, a clear majority of production based on hydropower. And then you're moving into solar, wind, or even green hydrogen, biofuels and batteries. So how are you prioritizing? Because as you said, there's a lot of option and optionality. But how do you kind of find the right horses to play on, or do you bet on several horses? And how do you think this through?
The way we prioritize is analyzing the external environment that we operate in, where overarching targets like fighting climate change is one objective that we focus on. But we are also seeing what trends are there, what do we expect the market prices for electricity, gas, and other forms of energy to be. So we analyze the economic picture and the political aspect of it. Then we combine it with where we think we are the best company to add value. So the strategy is the crossover of where we think the trends are going and where we can add value. And in the combination of that, we look for innovative solutions. And this has been done in Statkraft for many decades, and it has brought us from being a purely Norwegian hydropower producer 30 years ago to today being one of the leading hydro companies in the world and moving into all the new technologies that you just mentioned. So we now have a number of renewable technologies in 19 countries in three continents. But it all starts with understanding then the surroundings and understanding where we can add more value than other companies so we can have success.
Yeah, but one of the things we're trying to figure out as academians is to how to create competitive advantages and maybe sustainable competitive advantage. And being so heavy and so competent on renewables, particularly then in, let's now use hydropower, is that a strength or could it derail your exploration into biofuels or green hydrogen or batteries for that sake? How do you see that? And how do you balance as a management then?
It is a balance. I mean, if we get complacent, if we think we are too satisfied with what we do, it is negative. But of course, by and large, it is a strength that we are successful in several technologies, in several geographies. And then we constantly have to judge how do we expand? Do we go into the known technologies into new countries or new technologies in existing countries? And we have to make a choice on the speed and where to go. I think innovation here is very important. If we see that we are coming up with new models, particularly new commercial models, that are unique to us, then we could go all in and move fast. Like, for instance, some years ago in Germany, an apprentice, a person that has started in Statkraft on a short-term contract, came up and said, he was a very skilled young man, he said, Statkraft systems for optimizing our own hydropower plants and other plants at the time are so good that we should offer this as a service to other companies. We sent down a management team. We thought, okay, let's really try. And today we are operating 1,500 power plants for other companies based on the system skills that we already had. And thereby we get a lot of knowledge of the whole market in Germany, and we can now sell renewable energy to all customers in Norway that wants it, because we're operating all these power plants. So this is one step after each other. So it starts with a good idea, but to implement it took a lot of effort.
Thomas, could I hop in here? You asked, you know, do existing assets hinder companies' ability to innovate? And I think they do. One interesting example is one of the companies in the energy sector that has, I think, had the quickest transition and an early transition is the Finnish company Neste. And one of the things that helped them is they're an oil refinery historically, but they didn't have oil wells or something, right? And so it was much easier for them to make a transition. They, for example, now are the world's largest producer of renewable jet fuel and renewable diesel. This transition, if we talk about sort of how they've done it, one of the things that's really helped them is they have very clearly articulated and communicated a lot. The top management team has spent a lot of time communicating with everyone in the organization what is their new strategy. That's really important. You can't, you know, communicate enough. You as a CEO, you can't be everywhere in an organization, but an organizational culture can and a strategy can, and they've spent a lot of effort on that. Sometimes I think in a time of crisis and quick change, there's a bias of some CEOs to spend the time on sort of thinking and not enough the time on communicating.
True, but Neste, they were already a large refiner based on fossil fuel, so they had all the refining skills which they could implement in the renewable space.
Yeah.
But they were still using the skill sets they had. But I think you are right saying that if you don't own the oil fields, it's easier to move away from a new source, new source of raw materials. Mm-hmm. But you still are building on the skill set of the company.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one of the things that I know from my conversations with Neste is that they have found, you know, that competent people is one of the resources, of course, that's hardest to have.
Yeah.
And one can actually retrain a little bit competent people in good ways.
Yeah, and you have like Ørsted, who actually sold off the oil and gas exploration part in order to move forward in offshore wind.
Yeah.
So it's about prioritization and it's about building new capabilities. But I have to ask, because how are you as a CEO constantly driving this focus on innovation? I can even see it's one of your core values, but How do you actually do that and go from ideas to commercial viable products?
My way of doing it is to do it in sequence. We have rounds of evaluating our own strategy, really overlooking, are we doing the right things with the right focus? And then that's an open process where we ask questions and we want input, and it's up for debate. Everything is up for debate. Well, that process has a start and an end. And the end of it is we decide what to do in the next period. And then it's totally different. Then it's hard communication and soft communication to the whole organization. This is what we are going to do. No questions asked about why, much about how. And then we do that for some period of time. And then we open up for a new round of evaluating our own strategy again. So to align the company in this different modes is very important. It can happen in different parts of the organization, have different modes at the same time. But generally, I think to open up the whole company in one go is the most effective.
Exactly. Carl, you've done a lot of research in innovation. And I think the title of the podcast is Innovation Caused by Few or Many. I think you are more into the many. That is a culture aspect, a structure aspect. Can you kind of put some words on it?
Well, I do think it's incredibly important to involve many people. I mean, I'm sure that any CEO has a lot of great ideas, but one needs to get, you know, everyone in the company contributing. Recently, I've done something called a meta-analysis. This is a way of finding sort of the average results of all research that's been done in a particular area statistically. One of the interesting things about the innovation literature, which is vast, is that most academic studies, they look at one particular element. For example, they explore, is organizational culture useful? Or is external knowledge sourcing useful? And these are important things to know. But as a CEO, one of the things that I think you have to think about is, where should you spend your limited resources? Where should you spend the money you have? Where should you spend the time you have? Where should you spend the focus of people in your organization? And so this meta-analysis I've done is try to take a broad brushed approach and looked at comparing different management practices that can drive innovation. Mm-hmm. And we found sort of about 130 articles that are most looking at this. That's representing about 330,000 companies, and found sort of the average results of this. And what we find is that external knowledge sourcing is the single most important activity. The second most important activity is having a strong, clear organizational culture that encourages risk-taking. And then the third most important is internal knowledge management, because one has a lot of learnings, but one needs to turn learnings from being individual to being company-wide. I wonder what you think about these three things, and, you know, if these management practices resonate with what you're doing in your company, or maybe you think there's something more important that should be included.
It resonates to me. But it is not my ideas that I want to implement. I'm privileged that there's a lot of ideas coming, and from all around our own company and from external. Mm-hmm. I think I would add to your perspective and say, I'm not sure if it's only the external input of models that are the most important. I think it's equally important that we are able to develop our own models, but it's both.
Yeah.
And we need to make that prioritization, as I just talked about. So one way or the other, we have to make up our minds as an organization, and that's a process. But with me as the ultimate decision maker on what to do, together with the board of directors, we have to make a choice. We cannot run in all directions full speed at the same time. So
sure,
this selection process is equally important as identifying all the good ideas.
Yep. No, I surely agree with that, and a number of companies that I've talked to have talked about having a fairly regimented sort of milestone process, where there are various, you know, formal decision processes if you're going to move forward in something. So collect all those ideas first, but then have a very systematic way of evaluating them seems to be a good thing. Yeah. And I surely agree with what you say about internal knowledge generation as well, and that's actually part of the element that I talked about in terms of knowledge management. In fact, I think one of the challenges companies have is sometimes the external knowledge sourcing and the internal knowledge generation, you know, can have some conflict conflicts with each other because, you know, the people inside are so proud of what they've done that they are sometimes not as open as they could be, not as spending as much effort as they could be in sourcing. So I think there is some balance. And I think one of the skills that's really important is to be able to pursue both of these things simultaneously. Yeah. That's something a lot of companies I've been talking to are working hard on.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm.
And going back to how you work, I mean, now you started as a Norwegian hydropower company and now become close to global. And when it comes to then innovation and creativity, are you having hubs, for example, in Southern America or other places in Europe? How actually do you do this? Is it R&D hubs or is it more that it's the culture globally which is important?
We have hubs, but it is the have people to move around so we can copy our own culture in several places, dimensions, geographically and organizational-wise is probably the best enhancer for creating a ground for innovation and successful business development. So, but there is a lot of good practices that needs it's to be done as well. It is always more important for us to operate the plants that we already have in a prudent, good and safe way. It's more important than the next innovation, because if the basis of what we're doing is not in good shape, then we can forget about growth.
I talk about innovation in a safe way. There is a notion that certain organizations say we celebrate failures because they want people to have a low barriers to try things out. How does it work in the energy sector or maybe in your thinking? Is that something you do?
Well, it's a kind of a try small and fail small. So we always have more new business initiatives going on than what we know we can handle financially and organizationally, because some will be successful and some not. I wouldn't say we are that good at celebrating the failures, but we are very good at accepting that to try and not have success is a good thing. Mm. But to cut off activities early enough is the difficult part, not to start them.
Perhaps I could jump in here a little bit. So one of the things I'm really interested in is I have a belief that when companies work in different parts of the world, they need to adapt some to the local environment. And one of the things that I think one can do quite well in the Nordic context is potentially this celebration of failures. The reason I think it's important is that, you know, it's hard a priori in advance to understand which of the projects you invest in are truly going to be that great innovation. That's why one needs to have a good process of different milestones to evaluate things, because you need a portfolio and some are going to succeed and some are going to fail. Now, the challenge is to have a culture that encourages this responsible risk taking. And when you have a failure, I think it's good to celebrate it. The Finnish company Supercell, for example, has a policy that they actually have parties and actually have a glass of wine to celebrate this failure. And the reason for that is you want to transfer the learning about a failure from the individual to the company so that each person in the company doesn't have to go through the same failures. On the other hand, if you would do this in China, a country that increasingly is, you know, important for innovation, I think since respecting face and not losing face is so important, this would probably be difficult. But if you look at China, to give one example, one company I've talked to in China is a company called VIP Kid. It's a unicorn, a company that grew to more than €1 billion of valuation very quickly. It was started by a young woman named Cindy Mi, who did her MBA at Cornell University in the U.S., not far from where I grew up. And she got really excited when she was in the U.S. about something that would fit quite well in the Nordic countries, that is very flat organizations and very empowered organizations. And then she went back to China and she tried to start this company, VIP Kid, which is to teach English online to kids 12 and under with native English speakers. And she had a little problem. So everything was flat. And then, you know, a super very experienced VIP customer would call up and talk to customer service and say, hey, could I talk to the director of customer service? And the response would be, sorry, we don't have any directors. You know, we're all equal here. And then, you know, there'd be an average employee in the company and they would say, well, you know, I would like to have a little bit of guidance. And they sort of, you know, because it was so flat, they really didn't feel they had that. So interestingly, it just didn't work well, having this flat organization. So Cindy had an interesting idea. She thought, why do we want flat organizations? And she and I would argue it is to capture ideas. And so she had the idea, let's have a more hierarchical organization, but 1 hour a week, let's have a totally flat organization. Let's organize a lot of knowledge sharing events that are cross-functional. Let's allow everyone to come into anyone's office and feel totally free that 1 hour a week. So this takes the concept, you know, of trying to getting these ideas, but does it in a very different way in China compared to Finland. So I think it is important that one thinks about how one needs to adapt to the local culture. Are you making some adaptions when your company is working in other parts of the world?
We are a Nordic country and a company, and we have this open door policy, and I think we have a low hierarchical function structure in our company. But actually, when we go abroad, we have to create a bit more hierarchy than our tendencies in the Nordics to have it work. And combining it exactly what you say, that we communicate that we want everybody to speak up and to take away the communication barriers between the layers. It is not allowed only 1 hour per week, it's allowed every hour per week. Mm-hmm. But we have to balance. But what we just discussed, to celebrate failures, is another thing. I mean, I don't know if you know which failures that company you just mentioned were celebrating. I think I like the notion, but in practice, I think what we should do is we should recognize that people try and they fail, but...
Yeah, so, I mean, to be clear, I don't think anyone would think that failing is a good thing. I mean, really great. But the point is that you can't know everything a priori, what's going to be successful. Yeah, yeah. So you do need to encourage what I would call responsible risk-taking.
Yes.
And the point about the celebrating of a failure is that it is a learning that is useful for the company if you responsibly and in a good way explored a new idea and it did not work out. You want people to explore that, to take that new initiative. And you want to make sure that people don't stick to that too long to waste company resources. So to stop it, celebrate it, see what one can learn from that. Yeah. And again, importantly, make sure it's not an individual. If I'm the person leading that, it's not just me that learns, but that I somehow share it with the company. That's the idea.
I think we can improve there because we are not good enough in celebrating our failures. But but I think we are good in trying many dimensions and stopping things.
What I think is, I think it doesn't resonate with business leaders too much to celebrate failures, but the way you contextualize it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I think that's how I also see it from our side.
Yeah.
But I think it's fascinating that you're now going into new areas like batteries, biofuels, green hydrogen. But do you then have different culture or different methodology? Because the maturity curve is very different if you are on hydropower versus some of these other renewables. Is a different way to work with it? And do you accept or motivate different culture in those departments?
I can't say that it's that different from a cultural point of view, but what differs the most is the revenue model. Okay. Where is the money coming from? How are we going to sell the hydrogen? Who is going to buy the batteries? What are they willing to pay?
The business model.
Yeah. The delivery system to install technology that we buy from suppliers has more similarities than how to get the money in. So we have to make sure that we understand the revenue side of the business before we do too much work on the supply side.
What's your reflection on that?
I think it's critical that one, is looking for new business models, of course. Of course, sometimes people do act too quickly. I do agree with you that, you know, you really want to understand the details in advance. So, yeah, I think you make a good point there.
Yeah, and I think it's and we need to kind of go to closing remarks, but I think it's fascinating that Norway has Statkraft, world's largest renewable company, and taking a global position, I think is fabulous. And also exploring new areas, which it's the more we put into it, probably the higher the success, but it's not gonna be a straight line. We don't go through various phases. And I think that's why the culture you're describing is so interesting, that we don't necessarily celebrate failure, but we take the learnings from it and bring it to the next generation and then work on the business models. But Carl, coming from this conversation with a leading CEO of one of the Europe's largest renewable company, what's your key takeaway?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that's really great to hear is even really large, established, highly successful companies are spending efforts to try to think about new ways of doing things. You know, innovation is important. And, you know, there is seems to be a recognition that one does need to capture the ideas of the many, you know, which is something I firmly believe in. And, you know, maybe moving forward, one thing that can be done even more is to find ways to work even more with startups, with students, with other actors that have other ideas. Sometimes this can be, you know, highly useful way of getting new innovative ideas into the companies.
And Christian, hopefully we can educate a lot of the next generation for companies like yourself. Any advice to Carl or myself how we should do that?
Well, what I took from this conversation is that I think we can learn even more from our own failures, from outside, from academia, and from young people coming into our company. So I think you should continue to do what you do, namely to educate people to be skilled, to be curious, but also to seek to work for companies that has the right set of values. That's what brings the world forward.
Well, it couldn't end on a better note. Thank you very much to Carl and Christian, and I hope you listeners enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Thomas.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.